Hi, this is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. And today I have a very special story to tell you and a very special guest. I'm going to devote the entire hour to one guest because there comes a time when you have to take life seriously and to actually think about what's going on in the world. And that's why I'm so happy to welcome Dale A. Jenkins to Joy on Paper, because his book is very important. I am so happy to welcome you to the program, Mr. Jenkins.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
To your book called Diplomats and Admirals, From Failed Negotiations and Tragic Misjudgments to Powerful Leaders and Heroic Deeds, The Untold Story of the Pacific War from Pearl Harbor to Midway. It's a big title. It's a wonderful, wonderful book.
Most of it's the subtitle, and it actually starts with the failed diplomacy in 1941. Yeah.
I have an enormous collection of military books. I've always been interested in the military. When I was thinking about, having you on, I wanted to make sure that I gave you enough time to explain exactly what you are writing about, because it is so true that people do not know about so many things to do with diplomacy, to do with the war, to do with planning. You know, we always talk about learning from history, and unfortunately, I don't know that we've learned a lot from history, but you certainly have put it in perspective, and I want to go, through the book in detail, but I just want to mention that there's one chapter that I particularly love, and that's chapter 16, where you talk about the Doolittle Raid. I think that is so beautifully written. I was like on the edge of my seat as you're describing how Doolittle, took off from the ship. And I was thinking to myself, this is such a great writer who can make me nervous whether or not Doolittle was going to take off. But you wrote it so beautifully. And I was really shocked to find out that this is your first book.
Well, I've been thinking about it for a long time. And the Doolittle Raid is about two-thirds of the way through the book. I think it's important to get some perspective on the entire situation, because we never had to have that war with Japan.
Exactly.
It never had to happen. And most people think, well, the war began with the attack on Pearl Harbor. Yes, that is true. The war began with the attack on Pearl Harbor, and our declaration of war by President Roosevelt the next day before Congress, when he talks about the day of infamy. But we have to go back several months, and in fact go back even a year or so to get full perspective on this. But over a period of time, in the last 6 months of 1941, there were a whole series of diplomatic discussions, attempted negotiations that were unsuccessful, largely because we had a Secretary of State, Cordell Hull, that did not understand much of anything about foreign relations. He was undermined by an assistant called Stanley Hornbeck, who was completely partial to China and was just down on Japan in every possible way. He, in turn, was advised by Alger Hiss, who turned out to be a spy for Russia. And if you're a spy for Russia, you want nothing better than to have a war between Japan and the United States so Russia can come in and pick up the pieces. We were undermined all the way along. And we had a brilliant, experienced ambassador in Japan named Joseph Grew, who had been there 10 years, really knew the Japanese, understood their government, he knew the people, and he was desperately trying to schedule a summit meeting between Roosevelt and the Prime Minister of Japan. There were several attempts at this. They had tentatively arranged for Juneau, Alaska in the third week of September 1941. And Roosevelt said to Cordell, okay, I'm ready to meet. Just get the thing scheduled. Well, Cordell Hull sat back and didn't do it. And I have to say that I wish Roosevelt had been more insistent on that. But, you know, he was most concerned about Hitler. Hitler was the big threat. Japan was considered the much lesser threat, and for good reason. And so the meeting that was intended for September 21 to 23 never occurred. And after that, the prime minister went to Joseph Grew and said, would you please send a letter to Roosevelt? Because Roosevelt and Grew had known each other since they were students at Harvard together. And Grew wrote a four-page letter outlining the entire thing in huge detail with all the background, with all the implications that were necessary. And it's specifically, if you don't have this summit meeting, the Japanese government under a very sensible prime minister, Prince Kanoe, is probably going to fall. The government will then be taken over by the army. And at that point, war becomes much more likely. Grew followed the normal protocol. He could have taken, you know, you're supposed to submit something to the Secretary of State if you're an ambassador. That's just the normal diplomatic protocol. Well, in this one occasion, this single occasion, he might have made an exception and sent something directly to Roosevelt for your eyes only. He didn't do that. He was a responsible guy. He did the right thing. And he sent it to Cordell Hull. Cordell Hull, if he even read it, probably didn't understand it. The whole thing was just shunted aside, and they just were talking about stale ideas that were just going nowhere. This was in September of 1941. There would not be another opportunity like that. They moved toward deadly for more and more contentious situations. And the real problem was that when Roosevelt had gone to the summit meeting with Churchill in August of 41, where they met off Newfoundland, which resulted in the Atlantic Charter, there had the Assistant Secretary of State, Dean Acheson, imposed a total embargo on oil to Japan. This created a crisis because Japan imported essentially all of its oil, and the vast majority of that was from the United States. So this was a crisis, and they were trying to force Japan to withdraw from the southern part of Indochina. The Japanese had gone through an extensive evaluation, and they came to the conclusion, at least the moderates in Japan came to the conclusion, we cannot possibly win a war against the United States. At the end of November 1941, remember, Pearl Harbor is December 7th. No, we're only about 2 weeks away. The end of November, the Japanese army agreed to withdraw from the southern part of Indochina in exchange for a resumption of oil. Cordell Hull took this as, okay, this is a great breakthrough. He circulated the draft agreement around to the British, because the British were in Singapore, the Dutch, because of the Dutch East Indies at that time, which is now mostly Indonesia, and the Chinese, because the Chinese were involved and there was this war between Japan and China that had been going on for 4 years. He circulated this as a draft agreement to our so-called allies. And he said, well, okay, you know, give me your comments. I'm ready to give this agreement to the Japanese and we can avoid war. The Dutch had really noncommittal comments. The British were a little bit concerned because a one-on-one agreement between U.S. and Japan might still leave them exposed at Singapore, but they were willing to go along with it. The Chinese were adamantly opposed, and they sent back a note directly from Chiang Kai-shek. If there is any relaxation of this contention with Japan, if there's any agreement with Japan, then we will consider that we have been betrayed, our morale will collapse, our army will collapse, and anyone, in fact, will pay the price for this in the long run. Kornilov was so shocked by this, and it was not only this note that came back, but the Chiang Kai-shek's wife, Madame Chiang, and her brother, Soong, they're this famous Chinese Soong family, had heavy lobbying capabilities in Washington. They spread the word around to anybody that was at all involved and would listen, and leaked to the press that the United States is appeasing Japan. And appeasement, of course, had a nasty connotation because of the appeasement of Hitler only two or three years earlier. So Kornilov was shocked by this. What do I do? And he felt that he couldn't possibly do anything contrary to the interests of our so-called allies, even though our so-called allies had very different interests than our own. Chiang Kai-shek would have been happy having our soldiers in China fighting for him. Kornilov could not make a definitive move in the interest of the United States. I say in the book, this was a matter of extreme disloyalty and terrible misjudgment. So what does he do? He gives the Japanese a different agreement that was a long-term arrangement that said, you know, over the next 2, 3, 5 years, Japan will eventually withdraw from all of Indochina. We'll settle the Chinese-Japanese war. They'll withdraw from China. And, you know, that will be something accomplished over a long period of time after this initial step has been taken. That was given to the Japanese. The Japanese saw this, and they said, this is nothing of the sort that we've been discussing. This is not only contrary to any discussions we've had, it's an insult, and it's an ultimatum. And as a result of that, the order went out to the carrier force, attack Pearl Harbor.
Well, you know, one of the things, Kornilov, let's talk a little bit about him, because I think what he did in so many aspects of diplomacy was just wrong, and that he won the Peace Prize in 1945 still annoys me, because he was responsible for the, people have heard, of course, they've seen the movie The Ship of Fools, the ship that came from Nazi Germany and had 936 Jews aboard, and he would not let it come to America. Explain, because most people don't know our current Secretary of State, let alone who was Secretary of State under FDR. But this is very important. He is very important. And his misjudgments and the things he did wrong are exactly what you're trying to tell people today. Wake up, pay attention to what your diplomats are doing.
Yes, we're in a dangerous time right now. We're in a very dangerous time. I think the most dangerous time in my lifetime, even including things that have occurred through the Cold War, because there's just lots of contentious situations around the world, in the Middle East, in Taiwan, even in Latin America, where the Chinese are creating relationships. There's a spy operation on Cuba that's just been revealed. But I consider myself an historian, not a commentator on current affairs. And if you wanted to talk about the Doolittle raid or other aspects of the books, you know, I'm happy to talk about that also.
Well, of course, one of the biggest parts of the book is the Battle of Midway. And when you take it through from the diplomatic errors that were made that led to the war, to Pearl Harbor, and I was really shocked recently, I discovered that even on the day of Pearl Harbor, within hours, as soon as the news came here in America, it was about 2:37 in the afternoon on a Sunday, and the newscasters right then started, you know, now we today about talking heads, but even at that time, they didn't have any information about what was actually happening in Pearl Harbor, and many of them thought it was, you know, just nothing, nothing major. And they're already on the radio saying it's a fragment of some, you know, military people from Japan who decided to do this on their own. and not a policy of Japan. So there was already apologists and people giving disinformation. And what I love about your book is when you talk about Midway and everything that led to that and the importance, really the importance of our understanding of that. So, you know, the turning point, of course, for you, as you mentioned in the book, is June 4th, 1942. And you describe this so beautifully. I think it's one of the best descriptions of Midway that I've ever read.
Well, thank you. I believe I'm the first person who has understood the battle plan that Admiral Nimitz formulated, which was not followed. Admiral Nimitz had a week to formulate a plan because we had the Japanese code broken. We knew their carriers were coming. We knew the date they were coming. We knew the course and speed they were going to be on. And so with that information, he formulated a plan that was going to provide for a concentration of force over the Japanese carrier fleet early in the morning of June the 4th. The planes from Midway were going to fly up the reverse of the Japanese course. We had three carriers that were stationed perpendicular to the course. And when our PBY scout plane found the Japanese carriers and confirmed that they were there, there would be a simultaneous attack by our planes from Midway and our planes from the three carriers. They would meet together in that concentration of force. That's what any battlefield commander wants to do. You always, whether you've got tanks on Europe or North Africa or anywhere, you always plan for a concentration of force because this is what gives you the breakthrough. So that was the plan. What happened was that our carriers were out of position. Why were our carriers out of position? Because our Admiral Fletcher on the carriers wanted to pick up his scouting planes. He had executed his own scouts in addition to the PBY planes. So he was about 50 miles away from where he should have been. And so the planes from Midway flew up by themselves. There weren't even that many planes from Midway. The Japanese Zeros came up, you know, and shot almost all of them down because they were grossly outnumbered. And meanwhile, our carriers were out of position. So they had to steam for at least 25 miles to get to within their operating range, which was 175 miles for our planes. Japanese planes could fly 240. I mean, they had many advantages over us. But they had to steam for 25 miles. So the carriers at 25 knots, it takes an hour to do that. So after an hour, Admiral Spruance had been detached. He had the Enterprise and the Hornet. He ordered those planes to fly on a southwest course because the best assumption was that the Japanese carriers would continue on the same course and speed, and our planes then would intercept them. Well, the Hornet and the Enterprise planes flew roughly parallel to each other. Some of the torpedo planes diverted off and they got shot down, but that unfortunately had no real effect on the outcome of the battle. The Hornet Air Group commander, when we got to the point where they expected to intercept the Japanese, there were no Japanese carriers there. The Japanese had meanwhile found their scouts had found our carriers and they had changed course to meet them. So here was Enterprise and Hornet finding nothing but open ocean. The Hornet Air Group commander turned to the left towards Midway, and as a result, his air group never found anything that day. Some of his airplanes ran out of fuel, ditched in the ocean. Some of them found their way back to the Hornet. Some of them actually flew to Midway and landed when they were almost out of fuel. The Enterprise Air Group commander thought, well, if they're not here, maybe they got delayed for some reason. So he decided to turn to the right, as it was, and fly northwest, flying back up the Japanese course in reverse of the Japanese course, thinking that if they were delayed and we fly back up that course, we'll find them. Well, he flew up there for about 15 minutes, didn't find anything. Meanwhile, they are really running low on fuel. He would have been entirely justified in saying, we can't find him. We got to go back to Enterprise, otherwise we're all going to ditch. He said, no, I got to find these carriers. So he flew to the north. He then found a Japanese destroyer. He could look down. They were at 19,000 feet. He looked down. He saw a destroyer. It could only be Japanese, heading northeast. He thought, I'll follow that destroyer. I'll take the same course it's on. And then if I don't find anything, we got to go back to the Enterprise. Otherwise, we're all going to end up in the ocean. He followed that. He saw some white slivers of wake on the horizon. He kept flying over some clouds and then came out from the clouds. And all of a sudden, there was the Japanese carrier fleet right underneath them. Yellow flight decks, big red disc painted on each one. He found the Japanese carriers, and that was led to our victory at Midway. There had been another carrier, the Yorktown, that found a third carrier, and the dive bombers for that plane, from that carrier, bombed a third Japanese carrier. The fourth carrier was able to launch an attack against our fleet. They managed to damage the Yorktown, which eventually led to its being sunk. And then the Enterprise flyers had gone back after they bombed two carriers. They went back to the Enterprise, refueled, rearmed, so forth, flew against the fourth carrier and sank it. But it was all a matter of this fabulous decision-making by the Enterprise Air Group commander when he was practically out of fuel. And this was all after the Nimitz plan had not been followed because our carriers were out of position. I don't know anybody else, if I may say so, that has understood that Nimitz had a battle plan and our carriers were to be 200 miles north of Midway, which was the position that made the concentration of force possible. And our carriers were not at 200 miles north of Midway. And the concentration of force never occurred. I don't know, frankly, anybody else that's understood that Nimitz had a plan for a concentration of force. We won the Battle of Midway, and if you follow football, it was like, it was not the concentrated force that won the battle. It was just like, you know, Patrick Mahomes, 15 yards behind the line of scrimmage, two linebackers chasing him, and he throws a Hail Mary into the end zone. That's how we won at Midway. It was that close.
Well, things always look nice on paper, but things don't always occur that way. And you're right. I don't think anybody else has written about what you wrote about, because I have 500 military books. I do a lot of research about military operations, and I tell you that the way you write about Midway, and just as I said, you write about Doolittle, this comes from a real understanding, and I know that you did years of research. You went to the original material, which is so important to a researcher, to actually go to the documents that were real and that you can put your hands on, and you can read sort of those little notes on the side that tell you so much that aren't in the official reports.
Yeah, a lot of documents were classified for 75 years. And so I was able to access things that people earlier that wrote about this period was unavailable to them. You can go into Office of the Historian. Anybody can do this on their computer now. Go into Office of the Historian, and you get to Foreign Relations of the United States Diplomatic Papers. And then there's by the year, 1939, 1940, 1941, so on and so forth. And then it's by region, Europe, Pacific, Far East, so on and so forth. Then you get into volume. Then you get into chapters. And then by the time you've gone through all of those processes, then you get to documents. And by the time you're there, maybe you've gone through all those steps, and now you're at 500 documents. That's an indication of how big this entire archive is. And in my book, when you look down and you see, whatever my footnote number was, and I say Foreign Relations of the United States Diplomatic Papers, and then I have year, Far East, volume, chapters, and document number. And I think I've got about, I don't know, I didn't count them, 25 or 30 of those documents identified, including the note from Chiang Kai-shek, November 25th, 1941, when he said, "You cannot possibly have an agreement with Japan." That was an ultimatum that he gave to us, and that's what Cordell Hull replied to.
Well, let's talk about a little bit more about the diplomats, because so much of the responsibility for going into the war falls on their shoulders. Nowadays, people don't know, but Madam Chiang Kai-shek was very popular in Washington, D.C. She was all over the place. She was at every fancy luncheon and cocktail party. And they knew what they were doing, and they knew what they were talking about and what their goal was. And sometimes when you look at it and you think, were our diplomats so naive that they didn't understand all the nuances between China, Japan, everything else, and between Chiang Kai-shek and the Chinese leaders at the time? You know,
they used us. That's right. They used us.
Yes, they did. And so I know you don't want to talk about the current situation, but what I want to do with your book, and I think it's important, and it needs to get more coverage. I would love to see you on every news show talking about this book, but maybe it will open people's eyes that if they read this, if they understand what went on back then, where we did not pay attention to the people who knew, like Ambassador Joseph Grew. He knew exactly, he understood what was happening. But they completely ignored him. They just bypassed his ideas completely. And they went with, well, the ones who were, in many cases, wining and dining them.
Yep, that's right. That's right. There were a lot of things that just weren't. One of the things that people didn't understand, even at high levels, even at the senior Navy levels, nobody believed that it was possible for a carrier fleet to move across 3,700 miles of North Pacific Ocean, requiring underway replenishment, and launch an attack on Pearl Harbor. They all thought that, well, you know, if there's going to be an attack, and there was indications that there was going to be an attack, but they thought, well, where could it be? Probably the Philippines, maybe Guam. Yes, there was. There were simultaneous attacks, of course. The Japanese had a massive operation going on with amphibious landings on Malaya and the northern Philippine islands, Guam. But even in the Japanese Navy, they didn't think Yamamoto could execute this. And he was, very smart, very aggressive guy. And he said, if you're going to get into a war with the United States, you got to win it on the first day. If we don't win it then, we eventually will lose. And his idea was, launch such a massive attack that the United States will think, considering the problems and the dangers of Hitler, maybe it would be better if we gave the Japanese, the western part of the Pacific Ocean, we'll be satisfied with the eastern part. So that was the calculation. That was the only hope they had to win. And of course, that didn't work. And they didn't win. But it took a lot of people, a lot of blood, a lot of years for that to happen.
You know, when I was looking at it and I looked at Cordell Hull's, page, wiki page, where everybody goes for information nowadays, there is no mention on his page, and he has a lot, very, very, very big page. They don't mention at all anything about Stanley Hornbeck. His name doesn't come up at all that he ever gave any advice. And again, it's looking at the diplomats. Who's giving them advice? Who's giving our current people advice? And who was giving Cordell Hull, our Secretary of State, advice? And that was Stanley Hornbeck. And then, of course, when you go to Hornbeck, then you discover that he was absolutely behind Elder Hiss. He believed in Elder Hiss. He wrote a beautiful letter to Elder Hiss saying, I believe you. I think you're the greatest man in the world. You know, none of this is talked about so that we remember, so that we might perhaps learn from history.
Yeah. Elder Hiss was suspected of being a Russian spy, and I've done a lot of research on Elder Hiss, but I think he was convicted of perjury. That was the only thing I could get him on. And so then he actually lived for a long time. He lived into the 1990s. But in after the year 2000, the Russians released some documents, and those documents showed that Alger Hiss really was a Russian spy. And he had been there advising Hornbeck, who in turn advised Hull, who in turn advised Roosevelt. And the crucial days of November 25 and 26, 1941, Hornbeck wrote this memorandum, which is in the book, about, well, I would wager of odds of 5-1 that there will not be a war with Japan for at least the next 3 months, or words to that extent. And you wonder what effect Alger Hiss had on that.
I'm sure he did. And this Hornbeck was very dismissive. Oh yeah, let's not worry. You know, we don't have to pay attention to this because it's not going to happen. And knowing now, it wasn't, I don't think, much of a question. Certainly in the 60s, I remember my father talking about that Alger Hiss was a communist. I mean, that, and yet so much of this was ignored.
That's right.
So, you know,
a lot of papers should not have been classified as long as they were.
Exactly. It was to protect these people so they could go on and do more damage. I don't know why, but we, you know, from your perspective, you look, and of course you're a Navy man, you love the Navy, you know, the situation with China at this time. They now have how many aircraft carriers? Three? They have three, right?
Something like that.
Yeah.
They're building them, that's for sure.
Yeah, they're building these aircraft carriers to challenge us. And again, how many people know this? How many people are aware in America? That's why I wanted to, you know, have you on today, because I want to promote your book, because I think that, you know, it needs wider circulation. It needs to be read by the people who are in power today. And hopefully it needs to be read by people who are in media today, because so many of the people in media are so-called talking heads. They don't read deeply. They don't understand so much. And I think what's beautiful about your book, I think it's so readable. Anybody can pick this book up, get into it. And as I said, because of your writing, because of the way you capture a story,
well, you know,
I think it makes it a book that it's not one of these very, although you have so much detailed information in it, the writing is so good that anybody can read Diplomats and Admirals. It's not a difficult book. It's a fun book. Because of all the things you bring in. And as I said, when I got to the Doolittle thing, and you're talking about how Doolittle had his foot on the brake, and he's waiting to get just in the right position. He's on the edge of the ship, and it was like, you know, my heart started beating. So that's why I think the people in New York and Washington, D.C., the people in our media and all of these people on television, they don't read enough. Your book is, I don't like to say it's an easy read, it doesn't make it childish, it's just a fun read, and I hope that you really get out there, do more publicity. I mean, I want to make a big reach. I'm going to really push this book on social media and to everyone I know, that I think this is a book that you should get for this year. You know, people say, they ask me all of it, well, what should I do? What should I know? What should I... you know, because I read a lot, they say, well, what, I'm going to tell everybody that they should be reading Diplomats and Admirals, because it will open your eyes.
Well, I appreciate that. I'm really an author, not a publicist, although I've got some help from my daughter, who's in this field. She's making some efforts to make me better known.
You know, my radio program is called Joy on Paper, and I always start off that it's for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. And in your case, the story behind your book is so important. What you're telling people is so important that it is not easy. What was the release date?
It was released December 1st, 2022. It's just over a year.
Yeah, just over a year. Well, that's what happens to a book. You release it and you get sort of this initial rush. People will invite you to come and speak to them. People invite you, maybe to organizations to speak to them. But then after a year, you don't get any publicity. I mean, I don't know how many, invitations you get today. But you should be getting lots of invitations. You should be on television, on the major television stations, because what you're talking about is relevant. I think that you, and I'm going to tell your daughter if she's listening, really get out there and push this book. Contact every single television station in New York and Washington, D.C. You should be on. You should be talking about this book because you have insights that so many others have not had. And as you said, you have discovered things about the midway planning that now relates to the planning that we're doing in, goodness gracious, can you believe there's a war in Europe again, a war in the Middle East, a war in dealing with China. You have deep insights, and you have to get out there and share it. You're not going to get noticed unless you push it. You really have to push yourself.
Okay. All right. I appreciate your help in that regard.
I'm going to do what I can. Do as much as I can. Because it's important. People will watch television and you see these man in the street interviews and they ask people, who's the vice president? And people don't know who the vice president is, for goodness sakes. So very few people know this story that you've written about. The tragedy that we landed up having Pearl Harbor 82 years ago. 82 years ago, people were ignorant of the facts. And you brought them forward now. But we have to do that with today's problems.
Yeah, we do. We definitely do. I had a public relations firm for 4 months.
It's not enough, because I'm telling you, when you have a book like this, I don't want it just floating down the Amazon River. I want people to read it. I hope that you are going to, speak to more events, get on more programs, because this is an important book. And I want to make sure that people know about your book. I think it's a fantastic book and one that people should be reading. Get this book, Diplomats and Admirals by Dale A. Jenkins. And you have a nice website, very, very good website. And I want people to check that out. But I want people to get this book and give it as a gift, because people are looking for answers. People are looking for hope. And if we don't have hope that we can learn from the past to make a better future, we're all in trouble.
Yeah, I agree. On Amazon, I've had about 155 reviews. Almost two-thirds, 64%, have been five-star. Most of the rest have been four-star. I'm at 89% five or four-star. There's a few people that kind of missed what I was saying, I guess. It gave me a couple threes and twos. But basically, I'm almost two-thirds five-star reviews. And there's been some very intelligent commentary. I've been complimented by the perceptiveness of people that have made reviews on Amazon.
Well, you're right. I will say the thinkers, the people who think, see the value of this book in so many ways, because it is this question of, are we ever going to learn from history? We keep repeating the mistakes and repeating the mistakes and thinking that we can put a battle plan on paper and not be ready for all contingencies, or underestimating the enemy, which is the biggest tragedy. You cannot say, we had Hawaii and Japan so far away, they'll never be able to sneak up on us. Yeah, well, they did. And that's exactly what happens if you don't learn from history and if you underestimate your enemy.
Yeah, I think there's a feeling in the United States that we're unbeatable. No matter what happens, it'll be all okay. We'll we'll come back and we'll win in the end. You know, there's a foolish self-confidence that goes on in the United States, and then we're living through it now. And we're going to have to worry about all kinds of peripheral issues, but the fact is, our whole existence could be subject to question.
Exactly. And that's the point of promoting this book, because I want people to wake up. There was a big tragedy here. And the biggest thing for our television commentators seemed to be after Thanksgiving, talking about what to do with leftover turkey. Excuse me, people, we have real problems in this world. Leftover turkey is not the important subject that they should have been talking about. There are people out there now who say, well, what can I do? What can I do? What can I do? And one of the things is to become knowledgeable, because if we don't know and if we don't think about what's going on and just sort of watch reality TV all the time, we're not going to be in a good place in 10 years from now.
I was recently asked to be a senior advisor to a group called Americans for a Stronger Navy. And I'm happy to be affiliated with them, strongernavy.org. There are people out there that see the need for our better national defense, and particularly considering what's going on around Taiwan, in the Eastern Mediterranean, in the Persian Gulf, in the Arabian Sea, in the Red Sea. These are all Navy potential hotspots, and we need stronger Navy.
You're right. Absolutely. And people don't realize that it was the Navy that was there after Pearl Harbor. It was a long time before we got any ground troops anywhere on any battlefield. It was always the Navy that was out there. And right at the beginning,
December 7th, we were awarded, and for 8 months until August 8th, 1942, we had no way to land any troops anywhere. August 8th, 1942, was when we put troops on Guadalcanal. But prior to that time, we went through all the Halsey raids. We went through Coral Sea. We went through Midway. And we fought the Nazi submarines in the Atlantic.
Exactly. The Navy was there. So, you know, I'm running out of time, but I want to, again, tell people to get your book. And it is fantastic book, and it is Dale A. Jenkins, and it is Diplomats and Admirals. But I want to thank you, and perhaps you'd come back again, and we break it down and talk about the Doolittle Raid and a few of the other chapters.
I'd be delighted.
Okay, so we'll plan that. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye now. Bye.